and welcome to the latest in the Eastern Arc podcast series. My name is Phil Ward and I'm director of Eastern Arc. This is an opportunity to hear from colleagues across the Eastern Arc universities of East Anglia, Essex and Kent about the work they're doing, the research they're undertaking, to talk about the issues that are raised and the findings that they've uncovered. Today, it's going to be slightly different from our usual format. We're only going to be hearing from one of our experts, Professor Alan Finlayson from the University of East Anglia. This talk was recorded at our conference in May, entitled Aftermath. The conference was an opportunity to look at the landscape following the huge events of the last 18 months, from the departure of President Trump and the swearing-in of Joe Biden, the departure of Theresa May and the swearing-in of Boris Johnson, but also the global pandemic and the UK's departure from the European Union. Professor Finlayson's talk looks at extremism online, political extremism, and the effect it's having on our universities, but on our political structures more broadly. He was given the task of speaking to quite a provocative title, which came about in discussion with the thematic champions for the human rights, equality and conflict theme for Eastern Arc. It was Deplorables and the Deep Web, going beyond the liberal consensus, and we very much wanted Professor Finlayson to explore the wider issues around online extremism and how it affects the political debate and the intellectual debate at universities. Professor Finlayson is in a good position to explore these issues. He's the investigator on a research project funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council looking at political ideology, rhetoric and aesthetics in the 21st century. It's a three-year project which examines how new technologies are transforming the ways in which political ideas are formed and circulated, and how this affects our relationship with our political beliefs and with their argumentative expression. He'll cover some of this in the talk. But with that, I'll hand you over to Alan.
Now, as the outline of the talk on the website explains, social media platforms have transformed, as it says, means of producing and presenting claims to knowledge and understanding. But in doing that, they have, I think, intensified a process that was already underway, one which involves displacing the university in part from the centre of the activity of producing and validating knowledge. And that's also enabled a wide range of forms of politics, a lot of them defined by their hostility to democracy, to liberalism, to flourish. I think it's one of those things that we all know is happening and one of the things we know is important, but is perhaps so large we haven't quite grasped the enormity of it. So really want to talk around that sort of shift in the ways in which what counts as knowledge and the politics around that have taken a different kind of shape because of the growth of certain kinds of online politics. But I'm going to focus in that on the particularity of sort of my situation, really, a politics specialist looking at people online mostly, doing, talking and thinking about politics, who would also reject my claim to be any kind of a specialist, and who might even think that my looking at them was evidence of the fact that I'm not any specialist in politics, but just someone else doing politics myself, a politics directed against them, that I have no particular claims to knowledge or understanding. I'm just promoting my ideology and looking at them as a way to promote that. And that's why I kind of like this title, Deplorables and the Deep Web, even though I kind of am anxious about it. I willingly accepted it despite not choosing it. I'm anxious about it partly because I'm not sure if there is a liberal consensus, if there ever was, or what it would be. I don't think we find a liberal consensus when we look very closely, or not even that closely, at people's politics. But also that word, use of the word deplorables, I think, sets a number of hairs running in my mind. I'm glad that we put it in quotation marks, partly because it reminds us that Hillary Clinton said it in the 2016 presidential election, and that was one of the things that affected her vote, but also because I'm not quite confident in the use of that word deplorables in this context. What is that context? Well, I think that context is one in which universities right now are going through a period, as we often do, of intense politicisation. But right now, a lot of that politicisation of universities isn't really to do with us, academics, or the students. It's government which is politicising us, and related people who support and express and articulate ideologies linked in part to the current government. I say that in part because I just read this week a publication produced by the Common Sense Group of Conservatives, which is made up of 59 Conservative MPs and 7 members of the House of Lords. And in their book, Common Sense, Conservative Thinking for a Post-Liberal Age, so they don't think there is such a thing as a liberal consensus. In the preface to that, the MP John Hayes explains that he thinks that the political situation in the UK right now is characterised by people having gone from Labour to Conservatives because they want what he calls a government that at last might reflect the will of the people, rather than pandering to the peculiar preoccupations of the liberal elite and the distorted priorities of left-wing activists. In his chapter, the MP criticises, first of all, John Stuart Mill for what he calls his snobbish belief in the superiority of the university educated, and also for failing to realise that the expansion of university education would, quote, ultimately create a new class of people characterised not by freedom of thought, but by its opposite, conformity to a particular narrow view of the world. He doesn't think that university expansion has made anybody more articulate or sophisticated. And in fact, he says that the new elite, what he calls the woke elite produced by universities, membership of that elite, he says, has nothing to do with intelligence. It is a class identity. Now, I start with that partly because it's in my mind, but partly because I think it poses the problem that is linked to the research I was doing about online politics. See, I could easily make fun of this document. The MP's chapter misspells the names of key thinkers it quotes. The biographies of all the chapter authors cite their university qualifications. And I could even make an argument about how this Conservative MP's analysis of the class identity of university graduates actually is a way of thinking about universities that goes back to different kinds of left, far left, and even Trotskyite political thinking. But I don't want to quite make fun of him because what he is doing and what that document is doing is taking part in a very ongoing and in some respects, in principle at least, legitimate contestation of the nature of the university, of what counts as knowledge, the significance of that knowledge, of who gets to say what isn't knowledge and who gets to speak in its name. And that's a critique we're used to in universities, in humanities, social sciences and other fields. It's a critique of the boundaries of high and low culture, of what should and shouldn't be, on literature curricula, of why we should do social history as well as the history of kings. It's a contestation of boundaries that is a fundamental part of an awful lot of university teaching and inquiry. But Hayes's argument is also part of a policy agenda that is already fully in train, reducing funds for university research, cancelling the ODA, GCRF funds, for example, using the platform of high office to weaken the standing of humanities in the eyes of students, and now in the Queen's speech, planning to introduce laws to control who we invite onto campus. And all of that is an argument I've been following unfolding for a long time, and particularly in the last few years online, where a range of political groups, individuals much further to the right than the Conservative Party, have been developing these kinds of critiques of universities, of academics, of intellectuals, and of the role of ideas in politics and in society. What we find online is a kind of, what there is a breakdown of the differentiations and divisions between different kinds of movements on the political right, so that ideas are much more flowing much more easily between, on the one hand, very extreme groups and much more mainstream groups. I don't want to call mainstream right-wing groups the same as extreme groups, but there's a movement, a much larger ecology of ideas shifting and flowing between these kinds of groups. And some of the kinds of arguments about universities and critiques of liberal politics that we find in the mainstream now have been percolating and growing and developing online for many, many years. In those parts of the online world that see the university as one of the fundamental institutions enshrining a liberal consensus that they oppose, staffed by what they would see as cultural Marxists. They don't mean cultural Marxists, it's a kind of code term for meaning all sorts of things about lefts and liberals and Jewish intellectuals and so forth. Inhabitants of what they sometimes call the cathedral that they want to bring down. Now, that context poses a problem for a researcher. What does one do when the people one is studying don't just hold views that we personally disagree with, but are actively opposed to the very activity that I'm undertaking when I'm studying them? And where am I studying them and saying things about them in forums such as this, or in academic articles or in newspapers, might inadvertently support their cause, because my very research can be proof for them that all academics and scholars do is turn people who don't agree with them into specimens who we put under our microscopes in order to find deviant and then denounce. In that context, the question is, does calling them deplorable help? Does it confirm, in fact, their claim that our work is just a way of doing politics and ideology? But what's the alternative? Do we treat these things neutrally, as if we didn't have any interests, professional and personal, at stake, as if they weren't, in some ways, a very direct, in some ways, an indirect threat to the security of lots of different groups of people in the country? Or do we try and put their deplorability into some kind of context to make sense of the political, economic, cultural situation out of which it emerges, perhaps even these deeper processes of conflict over epistemologies? Or does that just give the oxygen of publicity to groups beyond the pale? Maybe we have to think again about how our commitments to the university do necessarily entwine us in some kind of a politics, in some kind of a critique, even those who would use that critique against us. So that's a whole bunch of questions in a very particular kind of contemporary context, but hold those in your head if you can, as I kind of go on and talk about the research that I've been doing. So I've been studying all sorts of online reactionary right, far right and alt-right groups as part of a project with a very unwieldy name. It's called Political Ideologies, Rhetoric and Aesthetics in the Digital Age, the Case of the Alt-Right. So it's trying to bring together ways of thinking about ideologies, forms of communication and persuasion, the aesthetic appearance of things online, to make sense of how political communication argument is changing more generally, using the so-called alt-right and far-right online as a case study. Now, the context in which I come to that project is as a political theorist, and in that sense, trained in reading books about politics very slowly, in trying to understand or interpret them as texts that are carrying out some kind of action in relation to a broader political context. And I do that as part of what I think of as being a rhetorical analysis, trying to understand not just what a text says, but how it says it, the kinds of arguments it makes. Because from my point of view, those arguments, how those arguments are made, are inseparable from what the arguments are. And one way of thinking about that is that what I'm asking when I'm reading a text of political theory is, how does it position us as readers? Every text implies some kind of ideal rate reader, someone who would know and accept all the things the text takes for granted, someone who doesn't know what the text explains but might be inclined to agree when it is explained to them. So in that sense, the question I'm asking a political text is always something like, who would I have to be someone who believed in this? Or what would I become if I did? That's a way of thinking about a text, how it works. It's also a kind of imaginative, hermeneutical, interpretive strategy for understanding the politics that other people articulate and inhabit. And although that sort of approach comes in part from certain theories and methods of political theory, studying the canon of political theory, it's ended up making me interested in all sorts of non-canonical political texts, political speeches and reports, banners and flags and emblems and demonstrations, and how people argue online. So that's why I've become interested in what I've called political theory in the wild. What happens to political ideas and arguments when they escape the textbook or the seminar room and find themselves in the wild, trying to find a way to survive? How do they adapt to the ecology they find themselves in? How do they change that ecology? How do they behave? And from my point of view, that's also part of what the political theorist Antonio Gramsci described as destroying, quote, the widespread prejudice that philosophy is a strange and difficult thing just done by a particular category of specialists. Gramsci's point of view, and I agree, everybody's thinking, everybody's philosophizing in that sense, but in ways that we can understand and make sense of as part of an ongoing practice of political thought that everyone is in different ways involved in the canon and out. So the project that I undertook came out of that. I was interested in how online platform technologies, how forms of digital communication, Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and so on, were creating new opportunities and new means for people to share, express and argue about their politics. And I was interested in how those technologies changed the form and the feel of that political argument, both for those making it and for those receiving it, not at political meetings or reading textbooks, but with headphones on, watching someone talking directly to them on YouTube. Because from my point of view, that changes everything. It changes what the political argument is. Digital, shareable, participatory media position us in particular kinds of ways and change who we are when we think politically. And so they change what it is that we're thinking when we're thinking about it. Now, I'd originally thought of doing a project that would look at left-wing politics online or organising around particular political issues. But when I first started designing the project, which was long before we got the money, so 2015-16, you could see that more right-wing online voices were becoming dominant, were very successful, in fact, at arguing and promoting their politics online. That seemed like a good case, not least because I could begin to hear it influencing the ways in which students thought about politics. Certain fragments of phrases and ways of thinking about politics I could hear, I knew were coming from particular voices on YouTube rather than from textbooks or articles in newspapers or politicians. So that project is coming to an end now. We're in our COVID extension. So I've spent the last 3 years trying to make sense of the forms and styles of politics on the right online. What's that involved? Well, that's involved what the anthropologist Clifford Geertz calls deep hanging out, a nice phrase, hanging out on conservative, reactionary, right-wing, far-right forums on platforms like Reddit, on some of the so-called chans like 4chan and 8chan, which is a very visually and orally noisy and very as far removed from political correct as you can imagine channel, which has been responsible for producing quite a lot of the themes and memes that spread around the internet, even when people don't know where they come from. QAnon started on those forums. And for a long time, the three of us on the project made that part of our sort of daily news, daily social media digest. One of the things I did was watch pretty much every single video on YouTube up until about last year of a YouTuber called Paul Joseph Watson. Often I find people, anyone over 35 or 40 hasn't heard of Paul Joseph Watson. He is a UK-based, very prominent and successful conservative to libertarian YouTuber with millions of followers on YouTube. I watched all of his videos to try and understand how they were working, what it was he was arguing. We monitored Facebook groups, we followed other kinds of YouTubers, we read and a lot of the literature around all this, and most recently we watched and followed a lot of the QAnon activity online. But alongside that, we also, myself particularly, because that's my expertise, looked at texts from the history of conservative, right-wing, far-right and fascist political theory, to see the ways in which ideas developed in the 1930s, for example, were being picked up, used, reworked and rearticulated in online fora, how debates within US conservatism that have their roots in the 60s and in resistance to the 60s student movements, again, reappear and are reworked and redeployed in different kinds of ways in contemporary politics, including contemporary online politics. So we're trying to see how political theory had kind of moved from these books into the wild. So what were some of the problems and challenges of doing that kind of research? Well, a lot of them were analytical challenges, very hard to keep up with the speed of change. Everything moved so quickly online. Lots of the material we were looking at was immediate responses to things happening, sometimes elsewhere in the online world and sometimes in real world politics. And it became hard to know what was relevant, what was going to be significant, as it would be if you tried to report on every article in the newspapers every day. We had profound difficulties trying to think about how to make sense of the interaction, this isn't unique to us, of the images, the sounds and the texts online and which bits were most prominent, because it would be easy for me to reduce online material to just text because that's what I'm used to and I can make sense of, when of course what is experienced by readers is the sound styles, images, accents, voices and everything else that is going into these multimodal texts. And that made it difficult for us too, because we thought, well, how do we understand all this just by looking at one or two examples? Do we have to understand the whole subculture here, the different complex internal codes and argos that is developing? Not least because it's very difficult to tell when people are being ironic or not ironic, or how irony is being deployed to cover what people are saying, making it super difficult to understand what actually is going on. So there were all sorts of analytical difficulties. Were there professional difficulties? There were some a little. I was worried a little bit that we might have some kind of harassment and pushback. In the end, we had very little, partly because I didn't particularly publicise the project. I did get repeated emails over the first 18 months of the project from someone who'd read the summary description on the AHRC website and was convinced that I was up to no good and kept demanding to know what outputs were and threatening to report me to some kind of an authority for being biased. I just told them that if they wanted to respond to any of the academic work when it's published, they were welcome to submit articles to the journals in question. And I haven't heard from them for a while, but I suspect we might get more as outputs become more obvious, more prominent, and particularly as we have our closing conference. But we also had very practical issues in terms of what we were trying to quote and cite in the material that we were looking at when we were writing articles and wanting to bring forward evidence. How much of what we looked at should we put in articles? Aware that people will be sensitive about the kind of language that we were looking at and some of the arguments we were bringing forward, but you have to bring these things forward in order to show your the basis for your interpretation. So there were all kinds of problems in terms of quoting and citing the content, but also because that might be giving in the oxygen of publicity to people we don't think necessarily deserve it. I did originally in the project think that we would interview some of the online people that we were looking at. I decided not to do that in the end, partly because of concerns about publicity, but also I didn't think we needed it. We had quite enough material to be getting on with. In terms of personal effects of that, it was often, well, a lot, not often, it was always quite unpleasant. It was looking at lots of unpleasant stuff. Not just that I disagreed with it, but it was itself intended and designed to be aggressive and upsetting, some of it, certainly. And I would say, if I'm being honest, that over the course of the project did somewhat distort my personal and professional map of the political field of the present day. Some of you may be familiar with the political theorist Carl Schmitt, an interesting and influential political theorist, also a jurist for the Third Reich. And one of Schmitt's central concepts is that politics is fundamentally about the distinction between friend and enemy. Everything in politics comes down to knowing who your friends and who are your enemies, and that's what the state is there to do, to make that distinction and institute that distinction. Of course, that's something that other political theorists profoundly disagree with. But one of the key arguments that I found coming up on some of the very right-wing blogs I was looking at was an explicit endorsement of that Schmittian view, and in fact a delight that in contemporary politics the friend-enemy distinction was back and was clear and could be acted on. And an awful lot of what I was looking at was really about this is how to recognize the enemy, this is how to know your enemy and how to deal with your enemy. And in the end, that kind of made me begin to think very much in friend and enemy terms too, to think, well, I am looking at people who probably would want to cause harm to me as well as to all the people they're talking about. And that did change the way I thought about politics in some interesting kinds of ways. I mean, everyday politics, not academically so much. But also because I was trying to apply my method of trying to think as these people think, to think what kind of position would you have to be in to be the kind of person who thinks that this is the way to think about and act politics. What is the ideal audience and what's the, as it were, implied ideal subject of this kind of material, which is difficult, but I think was in some respects necessary. In part because while I think some of the people, there are people who say that I shouldn't do anything or say anything that indicates sympathy for the people I was looking at. And I do think some of the people we studied, particularly those on the very far right who are linked to the kinds of security threats and terrorist activity that other people study, they are unambiguously bad, dangerous people. Other people are also unambiguously bad, dangerous from my point of view. But also you could see that what was behind a lot of this, as elsewhere in the world right now, was an awful lot of pain, an awful lot of fear, and an awful lot of loss. And one of our key findings was that a lot of the content of this broad field of online right-wing politics, from fairly mainstream American conservatism to QAnon to intense forms of anti-feminism and so forth, that what was going on there, a lot of what drew people in and was part of what radicalized them, was what I would characterize as a kind of therapeutic discourse. That in fact, what a lot of these online voices were doing was offering not so much a political ideology as a kind of political theology with a therapeutic dimension, a proposition that if you understood politics the way they were explaining it, you would feel better about the world, you would feel better about yourself, you wouldn't feel guilty or shamed by things that were happening in the world, and you could begin to take control of your life and become a more successful, healthy and prosperous individual. And there's a clear overlap between a lot of this political discourse and kind of esoteric discourses about diet, bodybuilding, care of the self and so forth. And a lot of this discourse is giving people techniques to apply in their life so that they can feel better and happy, but also so that they can distinguish between truth and falsehood and live lives in the light of truth as they see it. So that finding about the therapeutic discourse links to some of the key findings more broadly of the project, particularly that there is the marked rise of what we called ideological entrepreneurs, individuals who take on the role of creating, generating, and circulating political ideas and arguments in return for, and partly because they can earn an individual income from it through the monetization of YouTube, through the donations received on platforms like Patreon and so forth. And those individuals are not tethered by party structures and obligations to party, even though they might support parties, certainly not tied by any of the regulations that still exist on the press. So they're individual producers of political content, and part of what drives their content production, as well as their ideological predilections, is the audiences they're seeking to build and maintain, and their interaction with those audiences. And those audiences are participating, responding to content, requesting different kinds of things. You get an intensification and a radicalization caused in part by the resonance of those interlocking interests. But also because of that, you also get a breakdown of the boundaries and differentiations between political positions, in this case on the right. Same thing happens on the left, I think, but I was looking at the right. Because one of the things they're very good at, these ideological entrepreneurs, is cross-promoting and promoting each other, inviting them onto their YouTube channels, sharing their podcasts, building a much broader community, even if people who in some respects disagree greatly. They're uniting in different kinds of ways, and that's bringing about a very interesting and very complicated convergence of positions on the right. What unites them above all is an intense, and this is unsurprising really, intense hostility to liberalism, but to liberalism understood as the attempt by states to force or require equality. And they construe that attempt to force equality as an eradication of differences. That's partly a rhetorical ploy to say that certain white groups have their identity under threat, but the argument that it's eradicating differences is a very strong one that they, a very prominent one that they make quite forcefully. They object to that attempt to enforce equality, partly then because it eradicates differences as they understand it, but also because they see it as fundamentally in contradiction with the natural basis of human social organization. So again, part of what unites them is a series of claims about the natural basis to inequality between social groups, between ethnic groups, between men and women. And part of their critique of liberalism is that it's an irrational attempt, it will necessarily be driven to force equality because it's trying to contradict the fundamental nature of reality. But really importantly, and this brings me back to where I started, they characterize that ideology of liberalism as belonging to a particular social group, a particular class. And they are fundamentally united, I think above all, in fact, by hostility to that class. What in sociology in the old days, we would call it the new class of technocrats and intellectuals, of white collar public service workers. In the discourse of the online right, broadly speaking, that is, they are characterized as, by some people, new class verbalists, people who have power over language, over words, over culture, people who have discursive power that they exercise and use against those who lack that discursive power. These are the cultural Marxists, people in positions of discursive power, pursuing their agendas through that power. These are the social justice warriors, on the term they use, who are pushing, as they see it, a particular idea of equality on others using their cultural, their power of cultural domination. Now, the thing is, that power is real, and it is in part exposed by digital media. One of the fundamental features of social media, I think, is that it disrupts and breaks down the contexts of public communication. What do I mean by that? A lot of meaning that we take from people's words and speaking is contextual, from what we know of a politician or a political movement, from the setting in which they say it, from the tone in which they say it. We can understand more broadly, or think we understand and interpret the meaning. So in this situation right now, there's a very clear context. You knew where you were coming, you know what kind of event this is, broadly speaking, the kind of expectations and codes of conduct. It orders the situation for us so we have some expectations and we can understand what is happening. That's good, that's helpful, can be sometimes quite bad, but we can talk about that in a different context. Thing is that in online communication, everything flows. Everything is ripped out of and displaced from its context. Words used in one place can be taken and used as citations very easily. You can take a Snapchat of a... Oh. Was that a 5-minute warning? you can take.
Hey, Alan, no, that wasn't a 5-minute warning. We're very close to a 5-minute warning. That was someone who needs to mute themselves, I think, and getting some sound back. But yeah, we're 5 minutes out.
Thank you. So online, you can rip words out of context. You can take a kind of fragment from an academic article about feminism or gender politics, find the parts you want, recirculate that, and use that to define everything about the group of people who write or produce or think such ideas. On online, fundamentally, we don't know who is speaking to whom because it's anonymous, we can't see them. All the things around us that might give people in academic positions an aura of authority are absent. They're all gone and destroyed. All our titles, affiliations, citations, keywords, which we might not like to think are there to give us authority, they are, those are no longer present. The genres that we write in, the ways we express ourselves, have no force or authority in that online world. That is, I could, in a way, a familiar situation. It's not just something that came with digital media, that crisis of legitimation of knowledge, not just social science and humanities, but of course, vaccine, medical science, climate science, and so forth, faces a deep and fundamental legitimacy problem online, where it's ripped out of context and recirculated and reused by ideological entrepreneurs whose interests are something other than understanding the climate or vaccines or political life. So, to try and draw things to a close, I think that just as the texts of politics, as I describe them, require us to take up a position towards the world, so of course does academic life and academic research. And sometimes in academic life that does cause us to make people and things that we study into objects of a kind, and it can cause us to disregard some people's experiences and arguments in advance. And we do develop a language that we use for ourselves. I think we have to, but I think that's not unproblematic. I also think, however, that our academic practices and our desires to understand and make sense of the world do commit us in some way to a certain kind of epistemological politics, even in the thinnest kind of sense, to some idea of progress, for example. That's what we're asking when we ask our PhD students or our colleagues, what contribution are you making? How are you building to and adding to the progressive development of knowledge and understanding, even if that development is a critical one by knocking something down? But we have a problem when we take that criteria from our research and apply it to people in the world that we're studying, particularly in the case of politics. And we might end up treating political phenomena or people that we see as at fault for failing to make a contribution, for not being part of the general tendency to progress as we understand it. And there's a risk that we explain or understand them through that judgment, simply seeing them as deviant, departing from the path of what is supposed to be happening. That's one of the things online reaction right-wingers make fun of academics for. They call it the trope of the current year, people trying to justify a position by saying, it's 2020, how can you? And they make fun of us for a certain set of assumptions about progress and development that they're exactly the ones that they want to undermine and mock us for holding. But I think the problem then is that sometimes rather than try and put things into their context and see how they make sense in relation to a whole set of experiences that people might have as part of a larger social development, we can also end up doing a kind of counter therapy thinking, thinking that we're the ones who are supposed to make people better by freeing them from their everyday philosophies. And that can make it very easy for our critics online to say that we are just commercial and ideological rivals to the entrepreneurs online. Now, don't misunderstand me. Does this mean that I think we should be non-political about this or non-judgmental? Absolutely not. I think that we have to try and understand and make sense of the spontaneous conceptions of the world that people are developing and articulating and expressing and communicating in public and political life. They are part of the things I study, social and political life. I think it's good for us to try to deal with those conceptions, even when they are absolutely other than our own, and even good sometimes to take them seriously, to see what their logic is, to understand what it is that they offer people. I don't think we should be afraid of that. I don't think we should be afraid of giving people a certain kind of respect, precisely so that we can hold them responsible for the thinking that they are having and articulating. Because we have to make sure we know what's really there, what's really happening in politics. We have to make sure our own understandings are correctly questioned and opened up so we can make sense of what's going on. And we have to do that so that we can defend our intellectual practices. recognizing our power, therefore, in part, not so that we can exercise it, just exercise it over other people, but so that we can use it properly. So to go back to the title, I think we are already way beyond the liberal consensus. Maybe this is the effect of my being in this world for so long, far beyond than most people understand or appreciate. I think we don't understand that there are lots of people, and some very powerful ones, even in our legislature, who think that we are the deplorables, and we need to be absolutely conscious of that, intellectually and politically. Thank you.
I think that's a really interesting and important point to end on, the need for us to understand the logic and position of those we might disagree with so that we're able to hold them to account, and equally that they do the same for us. My thanks to Professor Finlayson for his incredibly stimulating talk, and to all of those who are responsible for this podcast and for the conference itself. I'd particularly like to thank Chris Martin and Jeff Harvey for allowing us to use their music. But I'd also like to thank our thematic champions for developing the concept of the conference and identifying particular topics that will be of interest. Do join me next time as we continue to explore the outer reaches of Eastern Arc.